Good evening, and welcome to Midnight Signals. I'm your host, Russ Chamberlain. Tonight, we journey into a story that has both fascinated and horrified many people for more than six decades. It is the tale of nine young hikers who disappeared under unthinkably cold conditions in the Ural Mountains of Soviet Russia in 1959. This is the Dyatlov Pass incident, and it remains a mystery with details so uncanny it almost feels like fiction. But as you'll hear, every element of this story is rooted in fact, however strange or chilling those facts may be. Imagine a land in the depth of winter. The wind howls across endless white slopes. The sky is a perpetual shade of gray, and the cold itself seems to whisper warnings that only the most perceptive can hear. This is the northern stretch of the Ural Mountains, a massive range that traditionally marks the boundary between Europe and Asia. The indigenous Mansi people inhabit the vast territory, living close to nature and passing down countless legends. Some say malevolent spirits roam the mountains, while others speak of guardian presences who watch travelers from behind snow-laden pines. Whatever one believes, most can agree on this. In the dead of winter, these mountains can turn from breathtaking beauty to a deadly menace at a moment's notice. Into this domain, in late January of 1959, came 10 young adventurers from the Ural Polytechnic Institute in the city of Sverdlovsk. These students and recent graduates were no novices to winter trekking. They had trained, prepared, and equipped themselves, aiming to conquer a challenging route near Otorten Mountain. Their leader was Igor Dyatlov, an experienced organizer known for his attention to detail and calm leadership under stress. Alongside him were eight others with strong hiking backgrounds and a shared love of pushing their limits in nature. A tenth member, Yuri Yudin, was also present at the outset, but that would change in the early stages of the journey. Few accounts reveal any sense of doom among the group in those first days. On the contrary, diaries and photographs paint a picture of camaraderie. They sang on trains, joked while cooking over makeshift stoves, snapped photos of each other posing amid the pristine snow. Their spirits were high even as they faced steep climbs and biting winds. The diaries provide glimpses into their personalities, a mix of determination, cheerfulness, and youthful daring. From these personal writings, one can almost feel the group's excitement to be out in the wild, away from the bustle of the city, testing themselves against the austere challenge that the deep winter presented. Yet local Mansi lore might have told them to tread with caution. The Mansi had resided among these mountains for countless generations. Their oral traditions spoke of places that demanded respect, including certain peaks and valleys rumored to host powerful ancient forces. One mountain bore the name Kolatsiakul, often translated as Dead Mountain. According to legend, hunters who ventured too boldly onto the slope sometimes never came back. To the Mansi, the mountains were not mere stone and snow. They were living realms where spirits roamed freely and where humans needed to show reverence. Whether the group knew the full extent of these tales is uncertain. They were aware of the name Dead Mountain, but likely dismissed it as a local superstition. Shortly after the expedition began, fate intervened. Yuri Yudin, who suffered from occasional health issues, found himself unable to continue in the punishing cold. His joints ached, and his condition worsened until he had no choice but to turn back. It was a painful decision for him, as he had looked forward to earning the same advanced trek certification as the others. Little did he know that this misfortune would ultimately save his life. The remaining nine pressed onward, setting up camps in increasingly remote areas, each day forging deeper into the silent, frostbitten wilderness. Their progress can be traced through diaries and photos they left behind. Each night, they huddled in a large, shared tent, a structure designed to fit them all with sleeping bags, a small stove, and their gear. Outside, temperatures could drop to minus 20 or even minus 30 degrees Celsius, with wind chill making it feel colder still. One diary entry mentions the thick, swirling snow that made navigation difficult and the sense of triumph when they finally reached a suitable campsite each evening. Another entry playfully teases one of the hikers for misplacing a piece of equipment. These are the voices of ordinary young people, full of jokes and minor frustrations, blissfully unaware of the terror that would soon engulf them. The days passed without their scheduled return or any message. In the city of Sverdlovsk, friends and family began to worry. Typically, Such winter treks could encounter delays, but each extra day of silence weighed heavier on the hearts of those waiting for news. Eventually, the local authorities organized the search. This search involved fellow students who knew Dyatlov and his companions, local volunteers familiar with the region, and even some military resources. They fanned out along the group's suspected route, mindful of how quickly a storm or a fall could incapacitate even skilled hikers. Those who ventured into the mountains in February of 1959 later reported a chilling atmosphere that went beyond mere weather. The sky loomed oppressively low, and the wind seemed unending, making every step an ordeal. Some searchers spoke of an unsettling quiet whenever the wind died down, as if the land itself was listening. Mansi guides sometimes murmured about places where travelers were not meant to tread in winter, but the precise route the Dyatlov group had planned was not considered taboo, at least not publicly. On February 26th, the searchers stumbled onto a baffling sight near the eastern slope of Kolatsiakul. They found a tent partially collapsed, dusted with fresh snow. Sticking out of this tent were pieces of gear and clothing. Inside, more items lay in disarray. Boots, cameras, notebooks, blankets, and ration supplies, all left behind with no sign of a struggle. Immediately, the searchers recognized this was Dyatlov's tent. Yet the manner in which it was found made little sense. Why would experienced hikers abandon it in sub-freezing conditions, leaving behind the warm clothing essential for survival? Then a more alarming clue emerged. The tent had been slashed open from within, as if the occupants had chosen to cut their way out rather than use the door. Footprints led away from the tent, downhill. They were shallow, suggesting hikers wore socks or even went barefoot. In the swirling cold of a winter night, no rational mountaineer would do that unless faced with an immediate, life-threatening emergency. The footprints spaced out, some veering, but most heading toward a wooded area about a mile from the tent. The investigators followed, anxious to find survivors, yet dreading what they might discover in the silent gloom under the pines. Near a towering cedar tree, the searchers found the first two bodies, dressed only in their underclothes. Signs of a small fire remained. The bark on the cedar was torn away up to several meters, as if one or both of the deceased had tried to climb in desperation. Their hands and feet bore marks of being exposed to extreme cold. Their fingertips were bruised and possibly wounded while shredding branches from the trunk. The scene spoke of frantic activity, but no one could guess why. Had something driven them here, or had they chosen this spot to help keep watch for a threat, building a tiny fire that could not hope to ward off the sub-zero air? Farther up the slope, between the cedar and the tent, three more bodies emerged from the snow, including Igor Dyatlov himself. They lay as if they had collapsed while attempting to return uphill. One had a fractured skull, another no serious external injuries. Their clothing, too, was incomplete. They had no thick jackets, no boots or gloves. Based on positions and autopsy later, it appeared they had died of hypothermia. Yet how they ended up scattered like this, fleeing a well-stocked tent, was still unknown. The ground revealed no sign of an avalanche or other large-scale disaster, and the footprints around the tent belonged only to the group, not to anyone else. It was as if they had collectively decided that anything was better than remaining in their shelter. Another question loomed. Where were the remaining four members of the group? Though searchers scoured the area for days, they found no further hint of them. The Soviet winter held them in a tight silence. Not until May, when the snowpack began to thaw, did another search crew notice a patch of disturbed ground in a ravine deeper in the forest. There, they uncovered the crude shelter made from branches and scraps of clothing. Underneath it, the final four were found. Shock spread to the search team at the condition of these bodies. Two had massive chest fractures, another had a severe skull fracture, yet their external skin wasn't badly damaged. Internal injuries were described by investigators as being on the level of a car crash at high speed or a heavy explosion. One body was missing its tongue and some facial tissue. Whether animals had scavenged it or something else occurred was hard to determine. The presence of what seemed like partial strip sharing of clothing indicated that these four might have survived longer, removing layers from those who died first. If that weren't enough to spur rumors, Subsequent tests showed low level of radioactivity on some of the hikers' garments. In the Soviet Union of 1959, the possibility of hidden weapons tests or nuclear contamination was real. The military had multiple secret programs in remote areas, yet no official record indicated an exercise that matched these facts. The local Mansi, when asked, repeated their old warnings about certain places being off-limits, even though there was no evidence that the tribe was involved in any direct confrontation with the group. Meanwhile, authorities eventually closed the case, delivering the famously vague statement that the hikers died due to a compelling unknown force. From that day forward, the Dyatlov Pass incident spawned endless speculation. One popular theory has always been an avalanche, though not a classic full avalanche, which would have buried the tent completely, but perhaps a small slab slide. The hikers, thinking the entire slope would collapse on them, might have panicked and fled in haste. Over time, shifting winds and further snowfall might have erased the usual traces of avalanche. That theory is plausible enough to some, but critics point out that none of the typical post-avalanche indicators were definitively found. The tent was still partially standing, the footprints remained visible, and why would a minor avalanche cause such devastating internal injuries for some, yet leave the earliest victims apparently unscathed save for hypothermia? Another idea centers around the secret military tests. If, late one night, hikers saw lights in the sky, flares, rockets, or something else, they might have panicked, assuming an explosion was imminent. The powerful shockwaves from an aerial bomb or a faulty rocket could explain the catastrophic injuries in the ravine, but no official records confirmed any tests in the area that night, and the Soviet Union had many remote test ranges that were far from these slopes. Those who advocate for a military explanation mention the radioactivity and the hush surrounding the final official report, but others say the contamination levels were too slight to strongly support a major nuclear event. Perhaps the radioactivity came from lab samples one of the hikers had inadvertently carried, as some were engineering students who might have come into contact with isotopes in a university setting. Then there are those who point to infrasound, a type of vibration below normal human hearing, possibly generated by wind hitting the specific shape of the mountain. Proponents argue that prolonged exposure to infrasound can induce physical discomfort, psychological terror, and paranoia. The group could have experienced a sudden wave of intense fear with no identifiable source, driving them to slash through the tent and flee. But critics still wonder, how do we then explain the violent injuries to the last four? Could they have tumbled into the ravine, being disoriented, and suffered mortal blows from the fall? Possibly. Yet the devastation to their chest seems severe for a mere tumble. More imaginative minds conjure images of cryptids or monstrous creatures akin to a yeti. Some in Russia call it a menk, a local legend about a large, humanoid figure haunting the snowbound forests. But the footprints in the area all matched the group itself, and there were no claw marks or tracks from any large animal. Others prefer supernatural explanations, suggesting that the Mansi spirits of Dead Mountain awoke in a fury that night. The missing tongue, the frantic climb up the cedar, and the sense of shared panic all fed an air of the uncanny. Those who support these theories say that not all footprints or signs need to appear if a supernatural entity was involved. Skeptics counter that such stories fill an information void but do not resolve any real, measurable data. In the decades following the incident, families of the victims found little solace. The Soviet regime was not eager to discuss or publicize an event that sparked such speculation, especially one that hinted at possible failings or secret operations. Files were locked away, and statements were kept minimal. Over time, partial documents surfaced. Autopsy notes and photos made their way into public consciousness, fueling wave after wave of theories. But for every new piece of evidence, contradictory details arose. The unknown overshadowed every attempt at a definitive conclusion. Yuri Yudin, the one who turned back early, spent much of his life grappling with the tragedy. He tried to piece together a rational explanation for why his friends had acted so counter to their training. In his interviews, he often expressed that they would never have left the tent unless they believed they had no other option. He vacillated on whether the cause might be natural or man-made, but ultimately admitted he would never be free of the question. He died carrying that burden, the only member of the expedition to see old age. In 2019, authorities reopened the case and again leaned towards the avalanche-based explanation, citing advanced computer simulations. Yet it failed to persuade those who dedicated to the more mysterious aspects. The statement offered did not tackle the tongue issue, the radiation, or the bizarre internal injuries with limited external damage. Officially, however, the avalanche theory is now the leading one. Many remain unconvinced, pointing out that official Soviet or Russian stances have often excluded evidence that complicates a narrative. To them, the Dyatlov Pass remains an enduring testament to something we don't fully comprehend. Meanwhile, local Mansi remain divided. Most disclaim any direct involvement. Some simply observe the mountain's name, Dead Mountain, predates Russian settlement, and certain places in nature have always been considered places of power. The Mansi worldview suggests that if you go there at the wrong time or bring the wrong energy, the land itself may respond in ways that defy normal explanation. Thus, what modern minds might interpret as an avalanche, infrasound, or secret bombs might align, in their eyes, with ancient beliefs in spirits who guard and sometimes punish. Even today, people occasionally visit Dyatlov Pass for memorial treks, filming documentaries or staging recreations of the night. Some claim to sense an oppressive atmosphere the moment they arrive, describing sudden exhaustion or the feelings of being watched. Photographs taken in winter often reveal vast, unbroken expanses of snow under a leaden sky. The passing wind scours footprints within hours, leaving the terrain empty and silent. For those prone to belief in the paranormal, it's easy to imagine shapes flickering in the corner of the eye or hearing echoes that don't belong to any living being. For the more pragmatic, it is simply a reminder that severe cold and mountainous weather can become lethal in minutes if proper precautions fail. The diaries recovered from the tent give us a final snapshot of the group's frame of mind. There are lines describing the difficulties of the day skiing, how the weather had turned harsh and forced them to camp sooner than expected, or how one of them joked about the wild wind sounding like a beast outside the tent. No entry hints at dread or despair, only the typical annoyances and small pleasures of a winter trek. And then abruptly, the diaries end. The hikers likely readied themselves for another night's rest, never imagining they would be forced out of the tent in a state of panic. As for the missing tongue and partial facial tissue on one victim, early investigators thought scavenging animals could be to blame, since that body lay in a running stream of meltwater. Yet the idea that only the tongue and certain soft tissues would vanish sparked rumors of a more sinister or ritualistic cause. Autopsy photos show the body in a state consistent with advanced decomposition in a wet environment, but that has not silenced those who see it as a sign of violence or the unnatural. Combined with the internal injuries in multiple victims, it forms part of a puzzle that has puzzled both official inquests and armchair detectives for decades. All told, the Dyatlov Pass incident stands as a stark reminder of humankind's vulnerability in the face of the unknown. These were competent, intelligent young men and women, yet they evidently encountered a situation so frightening they rushed out into the lethal cold. Perhaps the simplest explanation is a cascade of minor disasters. An unexpected snowslide, illusions in the night, confusion, and a fatal plunge into the ravine. Or maybe it was something far more extraordinary. Each observer brings their own lens. The scientist sees meteorology or terrain mishaps. The conspiracy theorist envisions top-secret Soviet weapons, and the spiritual seeker senses a cosmic or paranormal event. When we try to glean lessons, we see that thorough preparation can still fail. Even the most skilled can succumb to panic if conditions become incomprehensibly dire. The tent remains a symbol of lost security. The diaries and camera film, recovered from that battered fabric, reveal nothing of the final hours except the memory of happier days. The Mansi name for the mountain, Dead Mountain, now resonates in the media worldwide, bound to the tragedy of 9 lost souls whose story continues to captivate. For a moment, picture yourself standing on that slope at night. The wind tears at the canvases, the temperature drops below minus 20, the sky is a dark void. You hear a noise, unearthly, low, resonating through your chest. Suddenly, you feel a shift in the snow beneath you, or see flickers of strange light. Fear rises, rational thought recedes, and you choose flight over caution. By the time you realize what has happened, your boots are still inside the tent. The cold is biting into your limbs, and the silent forest beckons with only the false hope of safety. It might sound like a nightmare, but for Dyatlov's group, it was apparently very real. Some argue that the heartbreak of the story is not simply the violent deaths, but the fact that each hiker died without the world ever grasping why. In every photograph, they look like ordinary young people, smiling, sometimes jokingly posing with their skis. They might have had petty arguments or moments of irritation, but nothing indicated a rift that could lead to violence from within. If there had been internal conflict, the footprints or the bodies would show signs of struggle. Instead, we only see them scattering outward from the tent as if responding to a single cataclysmic fright. In the realm of popular culture, the Dyatlov Pass incident has transcended official discussions. It appears in books, documentaries, and countless online discussions. Even major film projects have used it as a springboard for fiction. The story elements, an empty tent, horrific injuries, a final night of terror, lend themselves to reimagining of horror and suspense. Often, these dramatizations lean on the creepiest details, like a vengeful spirit or a Soviet experiment gone wrong, capturing the public's appetite for an unresolved mystery. But behind the spectacle lies a painful reality. 9 real people, each with hopes and families, died in confusion and fear. And so, we close our explanation here, with the Dyatlov Pass incident remaining an enigma. The official record is incomplete. The rumor's unstoppable. The wind still sweeps over that slope, crossing the footsteps once taken by those 9 hikers in 1959, howling around a place that has become etched in the global imagination as Dyatlov Pass. We can reflect on the tragedy as both a testament to nature's indifferent power and a reminder that sometimes we stumble upon events that defy our most earnest attempts at explanation. The diaries end, the cameras are silent, and the final puzzle pieces remain buried in the snow and in hush. Thank you for spending time with me on Midnight Signals. I'm Russ Chamberlain, and I invite you to consider how this story resonates in your own sense of the unknown. Perhaps the simplest moral is that even the bravest, most skilled explorers can face a situation they are not ready for, especially in the realm where legends warn of forces older than any map. May we all carry a spark of humility when we confront the wilderness, or the mysteries that lie at the edge of our understanding. Until next time, stay safe, stay curious, and remember, there is still much in this world and beyond that can surprise us, even in our modern age.